difference if I speak like that and if I switch it off? Is there any difference whatsoever?
Yeah.
A little. Can you hear me like this? Would you prefer if I switched it on? Okay, then let's do that. Should now be on again. Did you hear a difference? Okay, because I can't hear. Okay, welcome to the first lecture of this lecture course, which is on the history of the English language. Welcome to the new semester. I hope you have much more energy than I have. The break was too short. It was spent doing wonderful things like Reakkreditierungsanträge and all those kind of things. But I did also have 2 weeks of holidays after that. But anyway, let's see how things go. I'll tell you something about requirements and things like this in a few minutes, but just to sort of get you into the mood, I'd like to show you this. And the question, of course, is, well, that's 2 questions. Which language and what text? Which language could sort of be easy, but yeah. Maybe Old English, yes, maybe you're right, yes. And? It's the Bible, yes, but it's not the whole Bible, which, yeah. It's the account when Jesus was born, it's the Christmas story or whatever you want to call it. Slightly untopical at the moment, I have to admit. But it's a very well-known text, and it's one where you, if you know what it is, can probably understand a few things. I wanted to start with this to make the point that there is a good reason for looking at the history of English, because there is quite a long history of English. We're talking about a history of 1,500 years, and a lot of things have changed. We'll be looking a little bit more at Old English in a minute, in the second part of today's lecture. But now, since I've made you, I hope a little bit interested in this, first about the aims of the course and some of the requirements, etc. I'd like to give you an outline, and with outline I also mean a sort of chronological outline of the history of the English language. Okay? So we're starting today with prehistorical times, before Old English started on the British Isles, and for the next 2 lectures I'll actually be going through the different periods of the English language in a fairly general fashion. This is a general comment I'd like to make about this lecture. I know that there will be some people also from the Alte Studiengänge in here. The main target audience of this is sort of second and third year BA or BEd students, so it is not supposed to be an advanced course in the history of English. So I'm going to do a fairly basic overview. In fact, some of you who are in the Alte Studiengänge, and I can recognize at least one or two faces, will actually, from time to time, see slides that they have seen if they've attended my courses before. I'm plagiarizing from myself, which is okay. You're not supposed to plagiarize from someone else, but if you're doing it from yourself, then that's okay to a certain extent, in the sense that you should obviously not do the whole thing again and again and again. But today and the next few lectures, I will be drawing on some of the things that I have used in previous courses before. In fact, this lecture course is a sort of reincarnation of a course which I already taught back when I was in Lancaster. And there, it was called the Historical Background to Modern English. And that's why the second point is here, add to the areas covered in first year lectures, that is sort of adding to the basic grounding in linguistic knowledge, and look at historical explanations to account for the present day English picture. So I'm not just doing a history of English for the sake of looking at what was in the past, but from time to time I will look at what's there today and how can this be explained, or how can this be linked up to what happened in the past. A require some skills for doing active research in historical linguistics to a certain extent. This is a lecture, but I will occasionally, particularly for those people who will have to do some assignments, will set those in such a way that you will be able to acquire a couple of skills in doing historical linguistics. And I will also not just give a chronological account, but I will also ask questions about why certain things change. The schedule has been uploaded to StudIP, a preliminary one. There might still be one or two changes. As I said, the first few lectures will be a general overview of different periods. And then I'll have a series of lectures on particular types of language change. So, for example, we will be looking at how the lexicon has changed in more detail. We'll be looking at how semantic aspects have changed. And I have got two guest lectures here. So these will be at the regular time of the lecture, but they will then not be done by me, but by two people who I've invited. First, we will have a lecture on the 21st of June, I think, by a colleague of mine who was also at Lancaster at some stage. She's now professor at Heidelberg, Beatrix Busse. She's going to do something on pragmatic changes in the history of English. And then Paul Rayson from Lancaster is going to do something in the last lecture on spelling variation, how to detect it in data automatically and how to correct it automatically, to normalize. Yes, as I said, the level is second and third year BA, BEd. So if you're very advanced students, you're very welcome, of course, but it's basically, it should be a revision in many respects. Okay. Good. Why is it interesting to look at the history of English? Well, why is it interesting to look at language at all? Well, you should know by now. It's a fundamental property of being human. We are social beings. And of course, language as such is not fixed. It's we have communities of language users that share certain conventions and that change these conventions all the time. Okay, there's some impressive gym work going on here, okay? Just don't leave midway, right? So it would be interesting to look at how these conventions change, because they are very important elements of our being human. And as I've said before, looking at the earlier stages of the English language can tell us something about why things are the way they are today, but also we can sort of link it up to certain general cultural developments of any sort. The last point is basically what I said before. We can perhaps understand some of the things better the way they are now in present-day English if we know how it got there in the first place. Now the requirements and the assessment. Some of you will be very much looking forward to that. If you are an old type student, old type in the sense of alte Studiengänge, then you just have to be there. And I'll give you a signature at the end. In fact, we're not even supposed to check attendance. So it's always funny. I mean, last year when I gave the lecture, there were, I don't know, at the beginning were quite a few people, then there were fewer and fewer and fewer, and then in the last lecture, suddenly all the people were back and wanted signatures. I then said at the beginning, okay, I'll just give you the signature, you don't have to listen through the lecture. But not a single person was honest enough to just get up and get the signature. They all sat through the lecture. But anyway, so you get the signature anyway. If you are a fourth semester student, can I have a show of hands? Fourth semester student. Okay? have to the same extent, let's put it like that. I would strongly recommend to do some preparation as well. Now, if you're a BA or BEd student in your sixth semester, yes, regular attendance, which again I cannot check. And secondly, there will be some short assignments which I have to ask you to do, which I will then also mark and return to you. And there is the dreaded final exam, which we have now set to take place in the first week of the semester break. It will be the same date and the same location for every lecture that's currently taking place in your sixth semester. So it will be the same also for the literature lectures. Please make sure that you register in time for the exam. You know how to do it. Okay. This is something for the BEd students. If you took Ling 501 last semester, you have to attend the lit lecture and vice versa. Did everyone know this? Yeah? Okay. We are supposed to check. It'll be easy to check because of the exam at the end that you have to take. Now, I'm going to record this lecture as I recorded. Why is that bad?
It's good.
Okay. Yeah. Because I've been told that there is a bit of an overlap for some people. So, as in the first year lecture, I'll be recording this. And I'm making it available to you. I'll be making it available to you via a link that I'm going to make available on StudIP. Check for download instructions there. It will invariably mean that the numbers will dwindle to about half or less, but that's life. I can live with that. Okay? It means that we have more space. Which also means, of course, that it doesn't make any sense to take attendance anyway, because you can listen to things at your own leisure if you so wish. Okay. Reading. There will be no specific textbook. I would like to recommend one book which I will hardly make use of, but which also is a good book if you are ever going to be in a situation where you have to describe linguistic features of different periods of the English language. She's very good at explaining these different linguistic features in a way that is not too technical and too detailed, but much more so than other History of English books that you may meet. Particularly when it comes to grammatical descriptions as well. As many of you know, I'm interested in grammar, I'm interested in syntax, lexical grammar, etc., which is also why this happens again and again to be part of what I teach, and this is a book which will help you there. It doesn't mean that you have to read this book and learn things by heart for the exam. But it will give you extra input. There is a further useful resource which I am occasionally making use of for the lecture, and which you could also consult for additional detail, particularly in the context of Lexis, but not only. It's a very comprehensive, it's now in its fifth edition, it's a much thicker book. It's The History of the English Language by Vaughan Cable. This should have been italicized, sorry. Both are in the library. They should by now be on the reserve shelf. If not, then I will make sure that this happens as soon as possible. If you take it out, it'll be recalled, so don't. Okay, in case it's not yet there. Okay, are there any organizational questions in English that you'd like to know that I may or may not be able to answer? Yes?
Is there already a date for the final
Yes, there is.
I don't know.
I forgot. Yes, I actually meant to look it up and then forgot because it's been a rather hectic day. Yes, we have the date. I don't know whether you can see it in LSF already. If you can't, send me a reminder and I'll either post it on StudIP or let you know by next week the latest. There is a date for it. Okay. Shall we do some overview of the prehistory of English and then also of Old English, particularly in the case of Old English. For those of you who've been to courses with me in the Alten Studiengänge before, there will be, as I said, sorry, a few slides that you've already seen. Some people are smiling there, yes, sorry. You're welcome to leave when you think you've seen this already. It will not happen throughout the whole course, don't worry. We all know this, right? This is how the different languages developed, as we all know. Tower of Babel. Not quite, obviously. Yeah? I think nowadays. It depends on many different factors, or on very different factors. Basically, the principle is that this is a social linguistic fact. When people talk to each other, they tend to talk like each other. We know this. I mean, that's why people in Trier speak the way they do, because they tend to talk a lot to each other, and they don't talk to people in Bavaria, and that's why they have a different dialect. Yes. Well, they might talk, but not to the same extent. Okay. And then, as a basically follow-up of this, if people don't talk to each other, then their languages will diverge. Okay. They become linguistically differentiated. Why am I actually pointing this to you? I should point this to me. Sorry. Okay. Right. It's not been my day. Anyway, yes. And this will then lead to dialect differences and ultimately to language differences. So the idea is if we have sufficient geographical distance, people will find it difficult to keep in touch to the same extent as when they live in the same area and will therefore differentiate the way they speak from each other, and that will then lead to the establishment of dialects and languages. You know about the fact that English and German are related. This is quite clear when you look at words like milk, bread, water, and flesh. Okay. These are so-called cognates. They are, in that sense, genetically related. And that's because English and German have a common ancestor. In fact, and I'm sure many of you know this, I kind of expect all of you know this, of course, it goes back much further. Here is a famous quote by Sir William Jones, who noticed, not for the first time, many people say that it's for the first time, there is actually someone much less famous, who made the same point about 20 years earlier. But this is the famous quote from Sir William Jones, who noticed that the Sanskrit language, which of course is spoken somewhere completely different, or was spoken somewhere completely differently in the East, the Sanskrit language, whatever be its antiquity, is of a wonderful structure, more perfect than Greek, more copious than Latin, and more exquisitely refined than either. That's not the important point. But the important point is, yet bearing to both of them a stronger affinity, both in the roots of verbs and in the forms of grammar, than could possibly have been produced by accident. So strong, indeed, that no philologer could examine them all three without believing them to have sprung from some common source, which perhaps no longer exists. There is a similar reason, though not quite so forcible, for supposing that both the Gothic and the Celtic, though blended with a different idiom, had the same origin with the Sanskrit, and the old Persian might be added to the family. Okay. So this was more than 200 years ago, someone realizing there is a common root campaign. And this was found out by looking at, I hope this is big enough for you to see, by looking at the same words in different languages and observing the fact that they are, of course, very clearly related. I mean, nowadays we say, of course, but back then it was a new finding. So these different languages, as different as Germanic, Celtic, Iranian, etc., are related in the sense that they must have had a common ancestor. That's also why we use kinship terms in describing the relationship between these languages. Okay. And there has, I mean, a lot of work has been done on reconstructing what's known as Proto-Indo-European nowadays, the common language that must have been spoken by some people somewhere. Okay. There is no record of it. Okay. I'd like to say a few words about this Proto-Indo-European, and basically we know very little about it, and it would be quite interesting to know where it all started. Okay. There seems to be this single ancestor for most of the languages spoken in, not all, okay, but most of the languages currently spoken in Europe, but we don't really know where it comes from. And I like the term, I mean, I think David Crystal mentions this. He mentions that this is a bit of archaeological linguistics. Because if we go back in history, we really only have language data of some sort, runes, etc., that go back to about 1500 before Christ. Okay. But all of this must have happened about 1.5 millennia earlier. We don't know where, we don't know why, and we don't really know how they moved. Okay. I mean, how in the sense of whether it's just one exodus from somewhere or whether it was a constant sort of to-ing and fro-ing, etc. And I'd like to present some educated guesses, but they are just that. They are educated guesses. Okay. It just is unlikely that we're talking about Africa, Australia, or America. Okay. It must be somewhere in Europe or Asia. And then people start looking at some of the earliest books and look at sort of geographical realities. Okay. The Indus, which is the largest river in Pakistan, is further to the west than the Ganges. Okay. And they're not, the latter is not mentioned, and the first one is. So that seems to suggest that that whoever moved in came from the northwest and didn't quite get as far at that time. Okay. We also can quite safely assume that the British Isles are not the source of Proto-Indo-European. Too remote. Too marginal. Okay. Now, how do you reconstruct this? And that's actually quite interesting. You start looking at what types of vocabulary there are that are shared. Because if you find the same word in all languages which presumably have come from the common ancestor, and you look at the type of language, type of words, then you might find out something about the language. For example, all of those languages share words for winter and snow. But there is no, or it's not quite clear whether there's a common word for sea. This suggests some kind of landlocked community. Or at least a community that for a long time lived inland. Okay. Here is a slightly longish quote that makes similar points. There are no ancient common Indo-European words for elephant, rhinoceros, camel, lion, tiger, monkey, crocodile, parrot, etc., etc. But there are common words more or less widely spread over Indo-European territory for snow and freezing, cold for oak, for beech, pine, birch, willow, beer, etc., etc., ant and bee. That suggests that, well, from the point of view of area, we are not talking about places where there are tigers and all those other things, but where the latter group is common. That helps us locate things a little bit more clearly. all of these Indo-European words, Indo-European languages have a common word for honey. And the alcoholic drink, mead. Okay. Where does the honeybee live? Okay. It's not found in those parts of Asia that some people have said are the source for Indo-European. Now, if there is no word for honeybee or for honey, okay, which of course you would need a word for if you are a speaker of a language and are confronted with bees, for whatever reason, whether you drink mead or whether you're being stung or whatever, I don't know. It suggests that it can't have been towards the east in Asia where people at some stage hypothesized this would have happened. But we don't really know. Okay, that was a bit of archaeological linguistics. I'd like to move now to the British Isles, and I'd like to say a few words about languages in England before English got there. We know, in fact, very, very little. Okay. Who were the first people in England before the English got there, and for whom we have some records? The Celts. Okay. Again, we don't really know why they're there, when they moved there. People believe that this must have happened around 600 before Christ, but they don't know much more. Then, of course, we've got Latin with the Romanization of Britain, and they were there for quite a few centuries, which suggests that Latin will have been spoken on the British Isles to some extent. To what extent by everyone is an open question. And then, of course, the important for the English language, the important event, Germanic conquest, which officially, as some people say, started around the year 449. Okay. This is according to the Ecclesiastical History of the English People by Bede, which is one of the major sources that we have for historical events at that time. It was completed several hundred years later, so there is some level of incertitude about the reliability of those dates. That's why I say officially, but it must have been around that time. This was an invasion or a conquest by three peoples, by three groups of people, by the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes, and they invaded the British Isles in fairly small numbers over a period of about 100 years. Mm-hmm. Now, there was a difference to what the Roman conquest had been. It was not to rule, but they just basically came for the money. Okay. They wanted to dispossess and then stayed, but it was not a massive migration of lots of people, but it was people in a number of boats, etc. A bit more than that, I guess. But it was different from the Latin, or from the Roman rule, sorry. This is a sort of geographical visualization of what must have happened. In fact, even the exact location of where those tribes used to live is debated in the literature from different areas of what is nowadays Denmark, Ireland, Northern Germany, and other places. They moved to different places on the British Isles. Okay? That's known as the Germanic conquest, and it's the way how the English language came to England, in a way, although it wasn't the English language. It was just Germanic. Okay. A few words about what happened then from the point of view of history. We had several kingdoms there, in fact seven, Anglo-Saxon Heptarchy it's called. These are kingdoms which are important if you're looking at dialect formation and different varieties of Old English to some extent, but I don't want to go into any greater detail here. If you want to read up on this, for example, Bourne Cable will be a very good source. It was, if we want to say it simply, it was quite messy.
Okay. For sort of every century, we have one kingdom which seems to have the upper hand, but there's quite a bit of change. In the 9th century, Wessex gained a political supremacy, which sort of united the country for the first time. But until then, we had basically a collection of fairly little kingdoms. Okay, what happened with the people who lived in England after they were invaded? What happened to the Celts? That's what, again here I'm referring to David Crystal, who wrote a really nice book, which is called The Stories of English. If you want to have just sort of a lightweight, readable introduction to many aspects of the history of English, I can also recommend that. It is much more, it's much stronger on the lexicon than on things like grammar and syntax, but it's also quite readable in the evening before you go to bed or something like that. I don't know. I'm not putting this down. It's not meant negatively. It's a sort of book for a general audience. Okay. And he calls it the Celtic language puzzle. Why is it a puzzle? Because what's left of the Celtic language in English? Very, very little. We have a few place names. Rivers, cities, etc. Hills. Okay. But we have very little else left. And this is odd. Because, as I said before, people who talk to each other tend to speak like each other. And the assumption is that, well, there were two different peoples being in contact with each other. They must have communicated somehow. Okay. They weren't all killed off or chased off or something like that. Okay. Why did they, in fact, not, I mean, the invaders not even sort of take over Celtic? This was something that the Normans eventually did when they adopted English. I'll talk about this later on, next week, in fact. Okay. If you look at other places where similar things happened, where people were invaded by other people, for example, in South Africa, then we have a lot of local color, a lot of local vocabulary in the lexicon there, and that doesn't seem to be the case for English of that period. Also, as I'll say next week, in fact, after the Norman conquest, after the French invaded Britain in the Middle Ages, or at the beginning of the Middle Ages, the language changed considerably, both in terms of vocabulary and also grammar. So there is clearly contact in situations like this that has an impact on language. Why not the Celts? Why not with the Celts? David Crystal mentions a few speculative explanations. And they are in a way related to this question of what is language and how is it linked to our identity as a human being. One possible explanation is that Celtic life had become, well, was so different from the Anglo-Saxon way of life that there was no motivation, that there was no linguistic reason, no social reason to borrow any Celtic words. I'm not sure that makes much sense. Yeah. Or perhaps, because that life was so different, the Anglo-Saxons didn't want to adopt anything because they considered themselves to be superior. So we would then have this conscience avoidance of speaking the barbarian language. I'm not sure. It could, in fact, actually have been the other way around. The invaders might have been impressed by the posh, Romanized Celts who were much more sophisticated than they and therefore, again, kept the distance. So we're talking about social linguistic explanations, basically. You did hear about social linguistics in the second semester lecture, and many of those aspects can be linked up to the history of English as well. Perhaps, though, and again, this is very speculative, It might have been simply so similar that, maybe two ways of life were so similar that there was no need for extra vocabulary. And in fact, Latin would have been the linking language that was needed to communicate. But as I said, we don't really know to what extent Latin was spoken by people other than the Romans. People have done some really interesting research that's related to genetic differences between people. We know that Celtic languages are still spoken today, Welsh and Gaelic, etc. And they looked at the genetic makeup of people who live in England, and who live in Wales, and who live in sort of northern Germany, the Netherlands, etc. And they found that English people and the people on the other end of the North Sea are actually genetically much more related than people who live in Wales with each other. Mm-hmm. This suggests what David Crystal calls an ethnic cleansing scenario. Simply, they were either chased out or killed off or whatever. So, that's a speculative explanation as well. On the other hand, we do find people of the nobility giving names to their children that are of Celtic origin. I don't know how many of you have children, but you choose your name, your child's name carefully. Mm-hmm. Parents think a lot about what name they would like to give their children. It's a sensitive issue. You wouldn't really give the name of to your child that is related to a tribe or to a people that you despise, that you are in war with or something like that, or at war with. So there must have been some respect for Celtic society. So that's why the big question mark is there. It is a Celtic puzzle. Okay, let's go back to this Old English, not out of date, but non-up-to-date text. It's not Christmas, but still. Three obvious differences when you look at this. Spelling and also pronunciation. You couldn't see this from looking at it, but presumably when you read it, it would sound very different. I'll play you a brief extract in a minute. Vocabulary and grammar. And I'd like to go through those three points very briefly together with you. Pronunciation first, and then related to that is spelling. We have words that are clearly the same, but where we have consistent changes or regular changes in pronunciation. We will come back to that consistent change later on in Middle English, towards the end of Middle English and at the beginning of Early Modern English, when we're talking about the great vowel shift. Where we had stan, we now have stone. Where we had hali, we have holy, ban became bone, richt, right, whose, house, etc. These are regular sound changes in the sense that when you have a vowel in this kind of setup, it will have changed 1,000 years later in the same way. On the other hand, we have many words which are in fact pronounced pretty much in the exact same way as it would be today. They are now pronounced in the same way as they would have been 1,000 years ago. So ship, back, that, etc. They are very close to what we have. We presume they are very close to what we have today. Spelling is different to some extent. We've got letters like the thorn, etc. But the pronunciation is pretty much the same. Few words about the writing system. We have basically a set of Roman letters in a particular type of writing which was very common across Europe. We have several exceptions. And these were basically letters that were added to make it possible or make it more easy to represent all what needed to be represented phonemically. There are no graphemes or no letters K, Q, Z, V, or J at that time. These are introductions at a later stage. Okay, I think we should try and listen to this now, to a bit of Old English. And I am no specialist in Old English myself, and I have a nice recording of one of the most famous poems that I thought would do this much more nicely. The problem is that the setup of the audio seems to be a little bit problematic. Let's see whether it works. I think you have to be very quiet, but you're quiet anyway, so let's see. Notice, by the way, before I start the recording, that there is something here in the middle. Many of you may have heard about Old English poetry already. If you haven't, try to work out, let's just listen to it first, and we'll see.
Nun Schulam Herriam, Herr vom richest Wert, Mertris Märte and his Mordia Thunk, Werk Wunder Fader, Swahi Wundroy the West, Echa Brichten, Or Anstelde. Hey Erist Shop, Erbe von Bernen, Helfen to Grove, Hallig Shippend, Thamidam Yerd, Monkinus Weard, Echa Brichten, After Theoda, Firm Foldam, Freya Ernichten.
Okay, sounds pretty English, right? Of course, these are reconstructions of what they sounded, and there will be different ways of reading Old English depending on what theory you subscribe to, but this is clearly something that is very plausible. Okay? This is actually Cadman's Hymn, which is a very, very early poem that goes back to about the year 600. It only got transmitted orally for quite a long time. There are several versions of this. This is a picture that shows you the very, very earliest survivor. You can see that the writing is sort of somewhat similar to what I tried to show you before. You can't read this here. Maybe on the slides when I upload them to StudIP, you can look at this in a bit more detail. But this is actually more than 150 years later, presumably. A brief translation. We have no time to look at this in greater detail, but this is basically, it's a religious poem, and I suggest you just read this yourself and see whether you can link the words once you look at the slides. This is poetry. What does poetry usually do? What do lines in poetry usually do? They rhyme, right? Did this rhyme? Some people vigorously shake their heads. Yeah, they didn't rhyme. Well, yes, they did, but the Old English way. Okay, but what's the Old English way? Well, the meter is very, very different from today's poetry, and the principle is not rhyme-based, but it's based on alliteration. So, sounds at beginnings of words would alliterate three times usually in each line. And if that was done, if that was achieved, it rhymed. Okay. If we look at Chaucer a couple of centuries later, that's different. That's where our common or our modern way of rhyming was already very much present. If you want to read up more on this principle of alliteration as a way of rhyming, then this is a link that you can follow where quite a lot is explained about how it actually worked. Okay, we're now halfway through the lecture. I personally find lectures in Germany too long. I used to have 50-minute lectures in Lancaster, where I used to work. That's a much nicer slot length for lectures. I don't know how we want to do this. I mean, I'm perfectly happy to give you sort of a few minutes of a breather, but I can't sort of have everyone disappear for 15 minutes unless you're willing to stay a little bit longer afterwards. Shall I mean, do you need a break? Would you be happy with 2 minutes of where you can just sort of chat with each other for a moment? In the first year lectures, that seemed to help. So why don't I just shut up for 2 minutes? You can make noise. Don't disappear. Take a breather, okay? Okay, let's start again. Shall we do that in future as well? Some people don't seem to be too interested in it, but generally speaking, can I have a show of hands who would like to do this in the future? In future? Breaks, the sort of 2 minute breathers. Okay, who doesn't want it? Okay, that's a minority, yeah. You'll have to chat for 2 minutes, I'm afraid. Okay, it's always also a little bit difficult to get back into the mode after this then, so please help me by coming back to it with me. Okay, if we look at the vocabulary of Old English, then it's very different from what we have today. And one thing that immediately comes to mind, or that you notice immediately, is that there is hardly anything Latinate in there. Okay. Nowadays, of course, we've got lots of Latin loanwords, but this sort of shows that this must have come in at a later stage. Those people who already know about the Norman Conquest, and many of you will obviously know that this is because of the Norman Conquest. There are some Latinate loanwords, but very few, mostly related to church, to religion, and to those kind of sort of official aspects of life. About 85% of the vocabulary of the types, not of the tokens, of the types have disappeared. Okay. I assume you remember what the difference between types and tokens is. I'm not explaining that now. Okay. What we have left, though, the 15%, are very general elements of vocabulary. So we have things like pronouns, prepositions, conjunctions, most pronouns. Interestingly, not all pronouns. I'll come back to that later. We have words like this. Man, wife, child, meat, food in that sense, or at least at the beginning. House, good, high, eat, drink, fight. Don't know about the last one, but I mean, most of them are fairly frequent and basic and important to general life. Yeah. So, in present day English, we have many tokens, but relatively few types that are around from Old English. In fact, when you dig a little bit deeper, you find quite a few interesting facts about particularly the lexicon of Old English that may not immediately be obvious to you when you look into a dictionary. Can you give me, unless you know this already, can you give me a hunch? What do you think? What type of word is blank? Is this a Germanic word? Or is it a Latin loan word? Who thinks it's a Latin loan word? Okay. Who thinks it's an originally Germanic word? Okay, about half-half. Okay. And who doesn't know, didn't say anything? The rest. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, blank, meaning devoid of writing images or marks, a blank page, a blank screen. Not completely filled in, if you look at a blank questionnaire. Devoid of thought. My mind is blank. Not having received final processing. Unfinished. A blank key. Okay, it's a collocation that you find quite often. Left white or fair. Not written upon. A blank check. Now, the original meaning, if you look it up in the OED, is actually white. So, and it is given as a borrowing from French, blanc. Blanc. Okay, yeah. Blanc at that time, I guess. I don't know. Anyone doing Old French? Okay, anyway. Yeah. But, which would suggest that it is actually a non-native element of vocabulary, because it was borrowed from French. There is plenty of evidence that it is actually a Romance word. If you look at other Romance languages, we find the same word in very similar meanings. Okay. Blanco, bianco, I don't know, branco. I don't speak those languages. And that suggests that it must have existed in what's known as Vulgar Latin, so the kind of common Latin spoken in the streets later on, let's say, 3rd, 4th, 5th, or later centuries. Bless you. Okay. What's white in Latin? What's the standard or classical Latin word for white? I wouldn't know either. I had to. My Latin is old. This is a long time ago. Albus. Ah, yes. Okay. That suggests that it's not an old Latin word. It's not one which got into French through Latin. Now, if you look at Old High German, there is a word which means white and shining, which is very similar. And this word actually made it into Old English. In one way or other. It meant a horse, okay, white or gray in color. There is, in Beowulf, you find Bjornas on blanco, warriors on steed. So, how can we make sense of this? Well, it must have become borrowed or been borrowed into Latin from a Germanic language. Presumably, and this is speculation again, some Roman soldiers or merchants must have heard the word and implemented it or adapted it into Latin, into Vulgar Latin, borrowed it, in other words. So, in other words, It is not a French loan word. Well, it is a French loan word, but it's a French loan word that actually started as a Germanic word before it came into the Romance languages. So there's lots of histories like this, and lots of little stories like this. And as I said, one of the books that makes those points quite nicely is David Crystal's The Stories of English. We have a lot of extension of the vocabulary going on by way of the word formation processes that I introduced in the introductory lecture in your first semester, particularly compounding and derivation. So via prefixes and suffixes. This is very similar to what we see nowadays in present-day German. What is bookcraft, rimcraft, steffcraft, and tungolcraft? Well, it's book skill, number skill, letter skill, and star skill. And what is that in present-day English? Well, it's literature, arithmetic, grammar, and astronomy. All of the latter words, of course, are borrowed from Latin and Greek, I guess, at a later stage. But in Old English, they would have been formed in the same way as we nowadays do it still in German. Okay. Here is a nice what if, which I like very much, but I can't find the source for it. I plagiarized it from somewhere. If you know where it is from, I'd like to know, because I, from time to time I show this, I can't find who had the idea anymore. This person looked at what English would be like if it had developed in a different way, namely just stayed Germanic. We'd have a fly haven today, we'd have a Stansted, well, we have an airport called Stansted, of course, but that's different. We'd have a Farspeak, ein Fernsprecher, as of course some of your, I don't know, grandparents might still say. Television would be Farsee. The pram would be a child wane. Psychology could be solar. Geology could be earth lore. And ferrous sulfide would be Irish brimstoning, etc., etc. You can make them up on your own. It's basically using the kind of processes that we have today that we used back then on present-day English with a Germanic root. Okay. If you want to read up more on prefixes and affixes, there are a couple of pages in Born Cable that I can recommend. I'll do this from time to time, that I just refer you to extra reading if you're interested. The kind of prefixes and affixes or suffixes used were not entirely the same from what we have today. Some have in the meantime left the language, other new ones were added. We will have a lecture on lexis and vocabulary where we talk about some of these aspects in detail later in the term. Okay, the G word, grammar. It's fundamentally different back then from what we have today. You will have, I hope, heard about the difference between synthetic and analytic languages. Is that something that you've done in the second? Have you talked about that in Dr. Schaefer's lecture? Yeah? Okay, good. By the way, if I'm just repeating everything that Dr. Schaefer said, then you also need to stop me. Maybe let me know after the end of this lecture, then I can still change some things for the next time. Okay, so I don't want to just bore you. Okay, but on the other hand, some repetition might help. Let me know. So, Old English is a synthetic language like Latin, and we've got the syntactic relations being expressed by way of inflections and other, indicating things like tense, aspect, mood, etc. So we've got tense, person, gender, number, mood, voice, and case. Okay. Just quickly, in Latin, we've got murus, wall. Off the wall would be the genitive. Okay. to the wall would look different. And the accusative is like this. You know about this, I presume. How many of you are doing Latin? Or have done Latin? Yeah, okay. Quite a few. Or in terms of verb morphology, they have praised. It's basically all in the inflectional morphology. In present-day English, we have an analytic language. Largely, these are black and white categories. We have some inflection left, of course, but much of it has been lost. And so these are labels which work to some extent, but they work quite well. Okay. It's an analytic language that uses grammatical words like prepositions. There are very, very few prepositions in Old English. They were not needed. Prepositions say something about how two elements in a sentence or in a clause relate to each other. And if you can do the same with inflectional morphology, you don't need prepositions. Okay. Rather than inflection, to express syntactic relations within sentences, which of course means that today word order is important. Famous or, well, often used, sometimes too often used example is dog bites man bites dog, means different things, obviously. Yeah. By the way, English is a second, and so an SVO language, not a second, the subject, verb, object language. The subject tends to come first. The verb tends to come second, and if there is an object, it tends to come last. Okay. There are other languages where this is different. Anyone doing Japanese? Yeah, okay. It's quite different there, isn't it? Yes. Let's not go into detail. But there are many, many possible variations or variants of this. English is a SVO language. In Latin, you probably have seen these. Before, word order is perhaps not irrelevant, but for stylistic reasons, but it is irrelevant to distinguish between the two sentences above, whether it's this, or whether it's this, or whether it's this. It's the same meaning. Okay, and the three on your right, again, the same meaning, and it's clear who bites who. I've uploaded a separate sheet to StudIP, which is a complete list of inflections or inflectional morphology and cases, etc., in Latin. Sorry, in Old English. Not in Latin. It is getting late. In Old English. Yeah? For you to look at, not for you to learn by heart. Okay, I will not be giving you a text in the exam, and you have to tell me which inflectional ending it is. It is purely for you to see what kind of system it was. Maybe next time I organize some drink. Drink some water. sorry, yes, okay. So Old English is really a little bit less elaborate than Latin, but it's still very similar in its system to Latin, and it's very different to present-day English, where we only have very, very few inflections. Most people count. I always forget, but I think it's seven or eight. I always need to think about them, but it's very, very few. Okay. Do you know what grammatical gender is? We have gender in English, okay, in Old English. You could tell whether a word was a female or a male word, okay, and is not dependent on natural gender, namely on considerations of sex in the terms of what it represents. Okay. The stone was male, the moon was male, well, der Mond is also male. The son is female, and the girl is neutral. Okay. Looks very familiar, doesn't it? I mean, in some ways. Mm-hmm. Wife was male. Male. Oh gosh. Okay. Yeah. You can collect these and put them online somewhere. Whatever. Wife was not male. Wife was neutral. Neuter. Okay. Child as well. Yes. Okay. In fact, woman was male. Okay. Because of the way it was formed. This is different than French. Okay. Where it's in many ways the opposite. And you probably have heard about this before. Okay. This was really only a very, very brief overview of some features of grammar. This is far from detailed. We come back to some of these aspects when we talk about grammatical change. How much do we actually know about Old English? How much data do we have? Very little, in fact. Okay. If we look at how many words of Old English we have, then depends on how you count different editions and things like that, but it's about 3 million words for a period of over 500 years. If you look at how many words Charles Dickens produced in his lifetime, that's 4 million words. You can see that it's not actually all that much for a period of 500 years. It's a few months worth of a daily newspaper. So that's what we need to use to base our findings and theories and whatever on Old English. We have nothing from the time before 600. We also have 4 major dialects in Old English. In fact, I've got a little map here, Northumbrian, Mercian, West Saxon, and Kentish. They were rather different. Okay. And in fact, looking at the different dialects of Old English and their differences is almost a lecture course on its own. Most of the texts that we have, not most, but a large majority of the texts are from the West Saxon dialect. The problem is, if you look at the succession or the how modern English developed, then this does not actually go back to the West Saxon dialect. So there's no direct line. So, in fact, we have most data for a dialect which is not an immediate precursor of present-day English. Also, of course, very few people could write. Very few people could read, but writing in terms of looking at language is more important here. They also, very annoyingly, did not always stay in the same area. They moved to different monasteries. They then brought in features of their own dialects into their work. There are inconsistencies in manuscript, which may be due to various reasons, one of them being different scribes from different areas. It may be human error as well. Okay. Some texts, in fact, have 4 dialects in them. Okay. We presume that this has to do with the different scribes. Okay. Difficult to distinguish between errors and sociolinguistic variation here. Sometimes, if you have very little data, something that is an error may actually be a reflection of social linguistic differences and variation. Sometimes it's just an error. Okay. Also, we have very few types of genres. We basically have a lot of poetry, and we have legal texts, and we have a few other text types, okay. Chronicles, etc. Poetic texts, at least today and for the last few centuries, have been always types of language used that are very innovative. Assuming that this was the case 1,500 years ago, then that language may not reflect to a great extent what was actually spoken on the street. So we know really very little about how people in old English times spoke. Last time I'm going to mention David Crystal today. He believes, and again I like this, that we should really be talking about linguistic detectives in a way here, rather than philologists or linguists or something like that. Okay, let's move on for the last few slides on the Scandinavian influence on English, which is a major influence, which is one of the major influences on English, which is still visible today, or which is not visible in the sense of that we notice it, but it is basically ingrained into the language of present-day English. You know the differences between shirt and skirts, right? Well, that's got to do with the Scandinavian influence. There were early raids by the Vikings towards the end of the 8th century. In fact, the important date there is 793, 6th of January, I think, where the Lindisfarne Monastery, which is on a small island off the Northumbrian coast, was sacked by invaders. They were interested in monasteries because that's where you could find a lot of gold and other riches. And this had a lot of impact across the Christian world in the British Isles and beyond. And it was basically the starting point of the invasion, of the Viking invasion on the British Isles. It became quite a massive invasion in 850 when we had 350 ships attacking East Anglia, and within a few years, quite a bit of the eastern coast of England, and in fact inside the countryside as well, was under Danish rule, under Viking rule. Again, the history becomes quite messy. The English tried to fight back. In fact, King Alfred defeats the Danes and comes up with a treaty that established a place where the Vikings were ruling while other parts of England were left at their own, under their own rule. This established what's known as the Dane Law, which is about this area, which is a major area of the British Isles. I can only mention this very briefly. In the 9th and 10th century, well, latter part of the 9th and the 10th century, we have a very unstable situation. The English got the upper hand again, but then we've got a renewal of the Viking fleet, and at that stage, at the beginning of the 11th century, all of England was basically under Viking rule. 25 years. Okay. And lots and lots and lots of Scandinavian settlers came over and settled, to settle there for good. Okay. What did they speak? Well, they spoke a Germanic dialect, very much related to the type of language that was spoken by the people who moved over in the Germanic conquest. It's only a couple of hundred years later, 500 years later or so. Would they have understood each other? What is 500 years difference in terms of understanding each other? It's an interesting question. Some people say, well, the Americans and the Brits understand each other. There's less than 500 years in a way difference. Yes, that's true, but we have standard English. Does someone from Liverpool understand someone from Texas and vice versa? Getting difficult. Okay. Let's look at what happened to the language. Interestingly, at the beginning, nothing happened. Well, nothing happened, or almost nothing happened, in the records that we have. We are, of course, tied to what we have in the text to look that we can look at. We really only have a couple of dozen words entering the vocabulary during the Old English period. And then in early Middle English, in fact, after the Norman conquest, we have a quite massive influx of Scandinavian words. We've got words like bank, birth, bull, calf, egg, guess, leg, race, root, scat, sister, skill, sky, lots of words, right? Skirts. Right? Okay. Those are nouns. Ill, low, meek, odd, rotten, tight, weak. Lots of verbs. Call, die. I mean, these are some fundamental, important verbs. Give. Get and give. Get and give are two of the most frequent words in the English language. Lift, lug, raise, scare, take. Okay. Thrust. Does anyone know what take, the old word for take in Old English was? Nieman, which basically is nehmen. Okay. But it was replaced by take. So we have very, very basic vocabulary referring to aspects of everyday life. That's odd. First nothing, and then suddenly these very, very basic words. How does that work? Why? In fact, even some aspects of the grammar, of the vocabulary related to organization, to the organization of sentences, is actually borrowed from Scandinavian languages. The pronouns they, their, and them. Okay. And both, same, till, and sort of what we nowadays have, to and fro. This is very unusual. Okay. You don't borrow prepositions. You borrow nouns. You borrow verbs as a language. Okay. It used to be we sind on, wir sind. Okay. It became we are. Again, of course, one of the most frequent verbs in English. In fact, the most frequent, the word to be. So these are closed class words which were borrowed from the language of the invaders. How can this be explained? This is, again, a little bit of a puzzle, and there are different ways to try and explain this. Now, first of all, we have a situation where very little was actually written, or at least very little was written that stayed, well, that survived. It was not a great area or an area where great literary works were produced at that time, the Danelaw. But still, why does this borrowing happen? And in fact, this borrowing happened not just in the Danelaw, it actually got into the language overall. Now, as I've already mentioned, did they understand each other? What's the impact of 500 years of separation? I mentioned the difference between British and American English, which are mutually intelligible, but the difference is that we're talking about the standard language. So it's not quite clear. Oh, I promised I wasn't going to mention David Crystal anymore. Here he is again. He talks about a situation, or he tries to explain this. He talks about the situation of emergent bilingualism. What happens when you're bilingual? Or what happens when you move with your children to a new country? The children will learn the language. You yourself will speak it, more or less. But it's really your children who will develop the ability to speak it natively. They will keep their mother tongue, to a certain extent, usually. They might even switch between them, very interestingly, sociolinguistically. And it's then really only in the third generation that the language shift has taken place. Yes, okay, I said all of this, sorry. It's got to do with prestige as well, typically. The language of the rulers in whatever way they rule, socially or whatever, will be the one that they apply or that they learn. Now, at the time when the third generation of people where there was emergent bilingualism happening would have been around, the Danes were chased out of the country and therefore no longer speakers of a prestige language. So there were people who were by then perhaps still bilingual, or in fact speakers of, well, Viking, well, of Germanic languages, but suddenly, in a way, they disappeared. Okay? So we assume that the level of bilingualism would have been fairly high, but English wasn't driven out because the Danes were driven out. Now, over time, these people who were now bilingual, or in fact perhaps even more familiar with the Germanic language of the Vikings, and who talked to each other and to the rest, to other people in the country, would have lost the negative associations of the people who conquered. Okay. You don't like to speak the language of someone who's nasty to you, right? It sort of makes sense. If that is no longer the case, you're quite happy to adopt features like that. And that would then have fairly quickly allowed these features to come into the emergent, well, let's not call it standard, but at least the language that was spoken then. And that's how David Crystal assumes that quite a few of those features suddenly turned up over the whole area where English was spoken. Seems like a plausible explanation. Again, it's an explanation which makes use of sociolinguistic factors like prestige and reasons of using a language or one variant of a language rather than another. Okay, next week I'll cover the Norman Conquest. I'll tell you something about Middle English. We'll say a few words about Chaucer. And we'll move over to Early Modern English. And now there's lots of noise again, yes. This will then be followed by a lecture on Late Modern English and recent change. And the rest is in the schedule online. Okay? See you next week.